From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The draft prepared for Mr. Blair by the intelligence agencies actually didn't say very much more than was public knowledge already. And Downing Street, our source says, ordered a week before publication, ordered it to be sexed up, to be made more exciting.
Andrew Gilligan, the BBC defense correspondent, filing a report on May 29th, charging that a top British official told him Blair had sexed up Iraq intelligence. Calls for Tony Blair to resign are increasing as questions continue to rise as to whether Britain, in fact, did this. We'll look at the scandal involving David Kelly, his death, and the BBC. And then a report back from Iraq.
The situation in Iraq is not safe and not secure. The U.S. is forcing a hostile occupation on the people of Iraq. We need to restore services to the Iraqi people so they can self-rule and bring our troops home.
We'll hear about the U.S. soldiers in Iraq, Iraqi civilians, from two members of the Occupation Watch Center and from the founder of a new women's shelter in Baghdad. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. At least 600 civilians have been killed in intense fighting in the Liberian capital of Monrovia in recent days. This according to Liberia's defense minister. Dozens of mortar shells were fired yesterday into the port city. At least two shells hit the U.S. embassy compound. Calls for the U.S. to send in peacekeeping troops intensified. President Bush said he's watching the situation. To date, the U.S. military has deployed 41 Marines to boost security at the embassy. 4,500 U.S. troops have been moved into the Mediterranean Sea, but it would take them a week to sail to Liberia. To protest Washington's indifference, Liberians laid the body of those killed outside the U.S. embassy yesterday. Analysts say the U.S. may have lost its best chance to oversee a peaceful transition from President Charles Taylor to a new democratic government, because now troops will be entering a combat situation instead of a ceasefire. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan called for the immediate deployment of U.S. and international troops. The Economic Community of West African States, otherwise known as ECOWAS, has pledged to send in 1,500 peacekeeping troops. We'll have more on this in a few minutes. President Bush yesterday issued one of his strongest warnings yet to Syria and Iran. Bush said, quote, "Syria and Iran continue to harbor and assist terrorists. This behavior is completely unacceptable, and states that support terror will be held accountable." Bush's comments came during a meeting in Crawford, Texas, with Italian Premier Silvio Berlusconi. The two met by coincidence nearly exactly 2 years to the date after Italian paramilitary forces shot dead Carlo Giuliani during the massive G8 protests in Genoa, Italy. The 23-year-old protester died on July 20th, 2001. The soon-to-be-released congressional report on 911 has found the FBI repeatedly failed to investigate evidence pointing to al-Qaeda members planning and meeting, most notably in the San Diego area, in the months leading up to the September 11th attacks. This according to a report in today's Newsweek. In one instance, the agency missed evidence of its own informant, who is in constant contact with an FBI handler living with two of the hijackers in San Diego. The FBI failed to keep tabs on warning that Omar al-Bayoumi, a key associate of the two hijackers and suspected Saudi government secret agent, met with Saudi government officials and the hijackers. When the report is made public, a 28-page section detailing the U.S. government's links with the Saudi and other governments will be deleted. Senator Bob Graham of Florida, who oversaw the report, charged the Bush administration is, quote, protecting a foreign government. This news from Britain. Prime Minister Tony Blair's approval has plummeted to less than 40% following the suicide of government scientist David Kelly. The BBC yesterday admitted Kelly was the source for its story that Blair, quote, sexed up the Iraq intelligence data to make his case for war. We'll have more on this in a few minutes. We'll be speaking with former parliamentarian Tony Benn. Attorneys for the Republican Party are warning TV stations not to air a new commercial by the Democratic National Committee that charges President Bush misled the country in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. The video shows Bush saying Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Republicans said the ad is, quote, deliberately false and misleading because the ad omits the portion of Bush's statement where he points out that the disputed information came from the British government. A letter from Republican counsel to TV stations in Wisconsin reads in part, the Democratic National Committee certainly has a legitimate First Amendment right to participate in political debate, but it has no right to willfully spread false information in a deliberate attempt to mislead the American people. As an FCC licensee, you have the responsibility to exercise independent editorial judgment to not only oversee and protect the American marketplace of ideas, the letter says, essential for the health of our democracy, but also to avoid deliberate misrepresentations of fact. The letter concludes, such obligations must be taken seriously. This letter puts you on notice the information contained in the above-cited advertisement is false and misleading. Therefore, you are obligated to refrain from airing this advertisement. The Washington Post is reporting the U.S. might propose to hold nuclear talks with North Korea. Under the proposal, the U.S. would promise not to attack North Korea if it begins dismantling its nuclear program and meets other conditions, including improving human rights. Multilateral talks would also occur with South Korea, China, and Japan. Newly released documents reveal Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force was examining Iraq's oil assets 2 years before the invasion of Iraq. The London Telegraph reports the 16 pages from March 2001 show maps of Iraq oil fields, pipelines, refineries, and terminals. A document titled Foreign Suitors for Iraqi Oil Field Contracts lists which countries were keen to do business with Iraq. The documents were released by the government to Judicial Watch, which had filed a Freedom of Information Act request as part of the conservative group's study in the links between the Bush administration and Enron. For 2 years, the White House had attempted to prevent the documents from being released. Retired U.S. diplomat Joseph Wilson is accusing the White House of orchestrating a smear campaign against him and his wife. Wilson gained headlines earlier this month when he revealed he'd personally visited Niger in 2002 in a CIA-financed trip to debunk any nuclear link between the African nation and Iraq. Wilson set off a firestorm of debate when he told the media the White House and CIA were warned in 2002 of his findings, this well before Bush gave his State of the Union address making the false allegation. Wilson now says the White House deliberately leaked to the press that his wife, Valerie Plame, is a covert CIA operative, thus damaging her career and compromising past missions. Writing on the Nation website, David Korn points out that whoever within the Bush administration outed Wilson's wife may have committed treason. Disclosing information that identifies covert agents violates the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 2002, of 1982. Plame's identity was first revealed in a column by conservative Robert Novak, who said government officials leaked him the information. fella. No agreement here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we move first to deal with the issue of Liberia. We go now to Sally Booker, who is director of Africa Action. At least 600 civilians have been killed this weekend in Liberia. A shell hit the U.S. compound where it looks like between 10 and 20,000 Liberians have taken refuge, killing more than a dozen Liberians. Their bodies put outside the embassy compound lie by Liberians to show the world what is taking place. Sally Booker, what do you think needs to happen? What should happen right now? Before we go to Sally Booker, we will go to Congressman Charles Rangel. I just spoke to him a few minutes ago about the situation and what he was calling for.
Well, we should intervene through the international community. It should not be a unilateral decision. We should get support from the African countries. But I think that humane reasons dictate that we stop the violence, we bring food and medicine, and restore our role as a really defender of democracy rather than one that liberates through bombing.
So you think troops should be sent in? Is there a discussion to get George Bush to do this?
Not unilaterally. I want to make it abundantly clear that I think all United States intervention internationally should be done by the United Nations.
That's New York Democratic Congressmember Charles Rangel. Sally Booker on the line, Director of Africa Action. Your response, what should be done right now?
Well, the Bush administration has been stalling all along. Before George Bush made his first official trip to Africa several weeks ago, the White House had met with the National Security Council, the Pentagon, the State Department to consider the urgent situation in Monrovia at the time and the requests of the United Nations and the West African nations and the Liberians themselves for the United States to play a lead role within a multinational force to establish peace and stability for the political resolution to be allowed to go forward in Liberia. And at that time, it's my firm belief that the Bush administration rejected any significant role for the United States, that it doesn't consider Liberia a serious interest to its own sort of minority rule here in Washington. And they simply decided to stall so that their decision not to be involved in Liberia would not become a major embarrassment during the president's trip to Africa. And so they sent a military assessment team to Monrovia that really looked mainly at the humanitarian situation, which is in just crisis proportions in terms of health conditions, in terms of the huge number of internally displaced people in Liberia. That mission has never reported back to the White House. The president went through his trip. He met with Kofi Annan shortly after returning from Africa. And he's continued to promise to offer U.S. assistance for security and a solution in Liberia. But like his other promises to Africa, whether it's on AIDS or whether it's on anything else, these are promises that are broken nearly as soon as they're made.
Bush has said he is watching the situation carefully. What do you think it is he is looking for with tens of thousands of people now concentrated right in his own embassy's compound?
Well, I think he's doing very much what his father did. In 1990, George Herbert Walker Bush, president at the time, faced a very almost identical situation. There were U.S. warships off the coast of Monrovia. They were evacuating Americans and Europeans, and basically they decided to leave Liberians to their own fate. And it was a very violent fate. They wanted the situation to resolve itself without requiring American intervention. And in 1990, that's exactly what happened. The rebel factions that were fighting in Monrovia captured the head of state, Samuel Doe, who had been an American puppet for the last decade of the Cold War, and they killed him and essentially destroyed the capital, and the U.S., you know, decided, well, there's no reason for us to intervene now. And I think that's what George Bush is exactly doing right now, waiting for some violent solution to present itself, whether it's the death of Charles Taylor or the triumph of one or the other of these rebel militia factions. But he's looking for a way out while simply promising that the U.S. will support the West African effort, which is, of course, itself also extremely slow in getting its act together.
Sally Booker, I want to thank you for being with us. Sally Booker is the director of Africa Action. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move now to Iraq, this news from Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair's approval rating has plummeted to less than 40% following the suicide of government scientist David Kelly. The BBC yesterday admitted Kelly is the source for the story that Blair, quote, sexed up Iraq intelligence to make the case for war. Police said Kelly committed suicide on Thursday. His body was found on Friday. Just days before that, Kelly was brought before the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee for intense questioning. Kelly's name first came to the public light after the government leaked his name as a possible source. Today, Prime Minister Blair insisted he played no role in, quote, outing Kelly as a source. Today's Financial Times claims Defense Secretary Jeff Hoon authorized the press office's strategy of confirming Kelly's name to journalists who came up with it. The BBC has to date backed the report by its defense correspondent, Andrew Gilligan. We're going to play now an excerpt of that report. That was Andrew Gilligan's report on May 29th.
What we've been told by one of the senior officials in charge of drawing up that dossier was that actually the government probably knew that that 45-minute figure was wrong even before it decided to put it in. What this person says is that a week before the publication date of the dossier, it was actually rather a bland production. It didn't the draft prepared for Mr. Blair by the intelligence agencies actually didn't say very much more than was public knowledge already. And Downing Street, our source says, ordered a week before publication, ordered it to be sexed up, to be made more exciting.
That was BBC's Andrew Gilligan. We are joined on the line by Tony Benn, retired from the British Parliament in 2001 after serving for half a century, the longest-serving Labour MP in the history of the party in Britain, and Toby Helm, chief political correspondent for the London Telegraph. I want to start with Toby Helm because you've been following the David Kelly story very carefully. Can you lay out the whole BBC controversy and what happened to David Kelly and ultimately leading to his death?
Well, as your clip from Andrew Gilligan made clear, the whole controversy started when Mr. Gilligan claimed to have spoken to somebody in the intelligence community who he said had told him that the government, and Gilligan said Downing Street was responsible for this, that Downing Street was somehow frustrated that the information that it had about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction was not dramatic enough, was not convincing enough to persuade a very skeptical public before the war that the danger from Saddam Hussein was as great as Tony Blair believed it was, and that in order to make the case more powerfully, Gilligan says his source told him that Downing Street insisted in inserting a line into a government dossier saying that Saddam Hussein could fire his weapons at 45 minutes of the notice being given. This was a sort of eye-catching top line, if you like, from the report, which was supposed to make everybody go, crikey, you know, we may not have thought it was that bad, but now we're convinced it is. When that claim by Gilligan was made public, Downing Street went mad, basically. Alistair Campbell, the head of communications, who was later named by Gilligan as the specific person who inserted that claim, began a vendetta against Gilligan. in order to try to get Gilligan to retract that statement. Campbell said this is simply not true. He rallied a lot of defense people behind him to back his case that it wasn't true. The row then escalated terribly. The hunt for the mole began. Dr. Kelly, an honorable man who'd worked for years on tracking down Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, felt under increasing pressure because he knew he'd had a conversation with Gilligan. He came forward, told his bosses that he had, and then the whole murky saga developed of Kelly's name being made public. Exactly how now is the main controversy in Britain. And in that pressure, and having given evidence, having been forced to give evidence to a Commons Committee, poor old Dr. Kelly killed himself. That's roughly where we are at the moment.
Well, Toby Helm, thank you for that brief synopsis. When we come back from our 60-second break, former parliamentarian Tony Benn will also be with us. Stay tuned. Second Baghdad, Rahim Alhaj, here on Democracy Now! As we listen to an excerpt of the late weapons inspector, David Kelly, when he testified before the House of Commons.
Is there anything in Mr. Gilligan's account which you dispute?
I think you'd have to ask me the specific question.
No, I mean, you've obviously read.
I have read.
Yeah. I mean, is there anything there that suggests that Mr. Gilligan was being perhaps, I don't know, careful with the truth?
It's not a factual record of my interaction with him. The character of it, which is actually difficult to discern from the account that is presented there, is not one that I recognise as being in conversations I had with him. There was one part of it which alerted me to that, which was the comment about the 30% probability of Iraq actually possessing chemical weapons. That is the sort of thing that I might have said to him.
Yeah, but really, Mr. Gilligan's story was basically about drafts of dossiers being changed,
yeah,
being sexed up, you know. I mean, did you sort of infer Mr. Gilligan in any way, shape or form that he might have misrepresented what you said?
My conversation with him was primarily about Iraq, about his experiences in Iraq and the consequences of the war, which was the failure to use weapons of mass destruction during the war and the failure by May the 22nd to find such weapons. That was the primary conversation that I had with him.
And you certainly never mentioned the C word that he went on to explain in his column?
The C word?
The Campbell word?
The Campbell word did come up, yes.
Ah, from you? You suggested it?
No, it came up in the conversation. We had a conversation about Iraq, its weapons, and the failure for them to be used.
So how did the word Campbell come to be mixed up with all that? I mean, what led you to sort of say that?
I did not say that. What I had a conversation about was the probability of the requirements to use such weapons. The question was then asked, why, if weapons could be deployed at 45 minutes' notice, were they not used? And I offered my reasons why they may not have been used.
And that was an excerpt of David Kelly's testimony before the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee on July 15th. Police say Kelly committed suicide 3 days later. Parliamentarian or former parliamentarian Tony Benn, it's a privilege to have you with us again. Can you make sense of all this at this point and how it fits into how people are feeling right now in Britain about the invasion of Iraq?
Well, the real issue, the real political issue in Britain and in the United States is whether it was right and there was justification for invading and conquering and occupying Iraq. Now, in Britain, because of the death of David Kelly, this has become diverted into an argument between the communications director at Downing Street, Alistair Campbell, and the BBC correspondent, Andrew Gilligan, each of whom are accusing the other of lying. Now, this, in a way, is convenient for the Prime Minister because it diverts attention from whether he should have gone to war, but it's also very awkward for him because Dr. Kelly, a very distinguished scientist, had his name put into the public domain, appeared before a parliamentary committee, found it very distressing, and apparently committed suicide. But that doesn't really divert from the question at issue, which is about the war.
One quick question. Do you believe he committed suicide?
Well, I'm going on what I'm told. I mean, the possibility that his death might have been by other means is something that may go on and on and on, like Marilyn Monroe's death and Kennedy's death and Princess Diana's death, but I'm not interested in that. The real question is whether the war was justified. And if you go back over history a little bit, it appears to me, having heard President Bush speak to the General Assembly, I watched the whole thing on television, as if he had decided then to go to war. The object, as far as I can make out, was to topple Saddam and maybe get American control of the oil. And then Blair went to see him, and Blair said it should go to the UN. Now, he got a lot of credit for this at the time, but as a matter of fact, it would appear as if Bush was only ready to let Blix and the inspectors go back because it would take him 6 months to get his troops into position. And so Blix was sent in, and Blix said, I need a little bit more time. But that was by then the American forces were ready, so Blix was sent away, and war was declared, and Iraq was occupied and conquered. And the Prime Minister's difficulty is that he was telling us for months that it was all about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Now, I don't think it ever was, and the British dossiers, one of them was picked up from an internet account of a PhD thesis written years ago, and then these words were added about Saddam having a capacity within 45 minutes to use his weapons, and that was used to justify a vote in the British Parliament for war. People don't believe that anymore. And so the thing has degenerated into this sordid squabble, really, between the government and the BBC, but loss of confidence in the Prime Minister has been the consequence for him, and the long-term political consequence of that we shall have to see.
Toby Helm, chief political correspondent for the London Telegraph. The Telegraph has done a poll right now of Blair's popularity.
Yeah. And it's pretty shocking, showing that almost as many people now believe that Blair should resign as believe he should stay on. 39% of the public actually think the sitting Prime Minister should resign. A fairly large figure, 41%, say he should stay on. But equally damaging, I think, is the fact, it's just the general, and this is borne out by another poll today, the general loss of trust in Blair. And one of the great selling points of Tony Blair was not any great ideology that he brought to the political debate, but it was a general sense in Britain that he was a decent guy, a kind of ordinary guy, a member of the real world who we could trust and who was bringing a sense of proportion, decency, non-fanaticism, non-ideology to politics, if you like. Trust was his great thing. Now that is being eroded in a very, very fundamental way. His government looks obsessive. It looks as if it has no sense of proportion. It looks like it runs vendettas. It looks like it makes the wrong calls on issues like weapons of mass destruction. All in all, I think if you are to spot a point at which the Blair administration went downhill, it's now.
And the public's confidence in the BBC, a very different picture than what we have in the United States, because the press in this country very much backed the president in the invasion, whereas the BBC took a different role.
Yeah, I mean, I think the public generally like the BBC, and the poll that we did showed much greater faith in the BBC than in the government. Also, I think the public find it quite difficult to grasp exactly where the BBC is supposed to have been a villain in this piece. I think there is annoyance with it, with the BBC, within the political system. The BBC has not behaved 100% brilliantly in this. But on the other hand, my gut feeling is that it's basically tried to defend the principles of journalism and has done so in good faith, if got it slightly wrong on occasions. And there's no collapse of confidence among the public in the BBC in this country.
Tony Benn, last...
The government would want us to think there is.
Last question, Tony Benn. As an observer and participant in world politics over the last half century, do you see any hope at this point after the invasion?
Well, I mean, the situation reminds me of the war that Sir Anthony Eden, the Conservative Prime Minister, waged against Egypt in 1956 at the time of Suez. I was in Parliament at the time and remember it very well. And, of course, then the United States, under President Eisenhower, was opposed to the war, and that led to the resignation of Eden and the end of the war, and British troops were withdrawn from Egypt and so on. And I think this is a very, very traumatic moment, because if you take the broad question, we've always been as a nation committed to the United Nations Charter, and we believe that President Bush broke the Charter and that Blair went along with it, and the arguments he used were not all truthful arguments. But the BBC throughout the war, in my opinion, gave tremendous support to the government. I mean, even to the point of cancelling an engagement I had with the BBC to do a broadcast on the grounds that I was known to be against the war. And this idea that the BBC didn't give the government support is nonsense, but this particular correspondent had an important story, which was that the dossier had been specially hyped up in order to make the war more necessary. And I don't think public confidence in the BBC will diminish, but I think the Prime Minister is in a position that people do not now feel obliged in any way to believe what he says, not only about this, but about anything else.
Well, Tony Benn,
confidence could be deadly for his long-term prospects of remaining in power.
Well, Tony Benn, thank you very much for being with us. Retired parliamentarian in Parliament until 2001 for a half a century. Toby Helm, chief political correspondent for the London Telegraph. As we turn now to Iraq. One U.S. soldier was killed, another wounded, in an ambush on a road northwest of Baghdad today. The attackers used rocket-propelled grenades and small arms in the ambush. The military had no other details of the attack, many of which lately have been staged with remote-controlled roadside explosions. The attacks follow ambushes on Sunday and Monday, which killed three U.S. soldiers and an Iraqi interpreter. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan threw President Bush a lifeline yesterday. Annan issued a report that recommends the Security Council recognize the Governing Council as an interim government. The council is comprised of 25 Iraqis selected by the American Occupation Authority. Kofi Annan called the council, quote, a broadly representative partner with whom the United Nations and the international community at large can engage. This despite the fact the U.S. retains a veto over all of the group's decisions, which include administering Iraq's domestic affairs, setting up a body to write a constitution, and planning elections. Annan also called on the U.S.-led forces in Iraq to set out a, quote, clear timetable for a stage withdrawal from Iraq. Today, we're going to hear about the current situation in Iraq from the founder of a women's shelter in Baghdad and from members of a newly set up organization there called the Occupation Watch Center. It's based in Baghdad, monitors the military occupation and foreign corporations, hosts international delegations to Iraq, and keeps the international community updated about the occupation. We're joined in our studio by two women who've just returned from Baghdad, Medea Benjamin, who is co-founder of Global Exchange, change. We're also joined by Patty Ackerman. Patty Ackerman is a reverend who is involved with special products and media liaison for the Fellowship of Reconciliation and a member of the steering committee of Code Pink. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
First, Kofi Annan's endorsing the governing council. Medea, you just came back from there.
Well, I think it's absolutely atrocious. This is a council that was hand-selected by the U.S. occupying forces in a secretive fashion without involving the Iraqi population, particularly the women that we have been involved with, had absolutely no say in this. And to now give it the cover of legitimacy by the U.N. would be really shameful.
Patty Ackerman, you have also just returned from Iraq. What about the role of women, first in the governing council? I put that question to both of you. And then what is happening now in terms of the violence now in Iraq?
Well, it's absolutely reflected in the governing council. Women are 60% of the population in Iraq, and they have 3 seats on the council, whereas Shiites have 60% of the population, and they have 60% of the council. So women are not being treated with any equanimity under Bremer's program there. He really has anointed a group of 7 women to form a steering committee to speak for all of the women in Iraq. A lot of those women have ties to the Bush administration and are Iraqi-American women. They, in turn, handpicked 80 women to come and have a one-day conference with Bremer. And a lot of the grassroots women, for example, our colleague Yunar Mohammed over there and any number of women over there have not been included in the process. There's no transparency. There's no communication with the CPA.
What about the U.S. soldiers? The casualties only compounding every day. The number of soldiers killed actually well more than what the U.S. government is saying right now, as has been pointed out in Editors and Publishers magazine and other places. They're just talking about so-called combat casualties. The numbers are 3 times higher with soldiers who are dying from so-called non-combat casualties, say in a car accident.
Or killing themselves. You know, we went there looking at the effect of the occupation on the Iraqis, which is terrible. And while we were there, we talked a lot to the soldiers, and we learned about the soldiers' plight. They're working in the terrible heat, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, sleeping in mite-infested cots without air conditioning themselves, getting shot at every day. And they're saying to us, we don't know why we're here anymore. We don't want to be here. The Iraqis hate us. We want to go home. And so as part of this Occupation Watch Center, we're now considering doing counseling for the troops.
Reverend Ackerman, can you talk about your conversations with some of these soldiers, who they are, why they are in Iraq? You describe vividly the reservists and the people who are now in Baghdad and in other places in Iraq.
Well, one entire convoy that I ran into at the palace compound where the military is stationed or ensconced themselves were all in combat dress, but they were plumbers, electricians, they were telecommunications people from the National Guard who said they had received 1 weekend of training during the past year. Some of them might have received the 2-week training in summer, but they said they were completely unprepared. The women, some of the women and the men we talked to said, you know, what a way to have to repay your college loans. This is not at all what I had bargained for. And one woman in particular said that, you know, if they ever sought out help or counseling, that they were tagged by the military over there and their weapons are taken away. And sometimes they're even sent home. So there are no resources for mental health that we could see on the ground there.
Can you describe in specific any soldier? You talked about one before the program, a young woman who was reading a book on a bus.
Yeah, absolutely. I was sitting on the shuttle, which goes between Baghdad Central and the palace, and there was this wonderful woman there reading a copy of Sister Soldier. And I spoke to her, and she's a woman of color from the D.C. area. And she was just saying that, you know, she watches the whole thing in operation over there and sees how it really mirrors the white corporate structure that people are forced to deal with every day. And that, you know, she just looks forward to coming home and, you know, maintains her very careful observing status in order to not be in the line of fire there.
You also talked about what it was like to be there as this dissent increases so much so that you had on ABC soldiers calling for the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld, and now the Pentagon trying to crack down on any voicing of dissent, both the soldiers as well as their families here at home. Recently at Fort Stewart, Georgia, 800 family members angrily confronted a military official. They were so angry that the military official was taken out by the military to protect him from the military families. Medea.
Well, imagine what it was like for us to be there when Bush made his comment about the attacks on the soldiers and said, bring them on. I mean, the soldiers were absolutely appalled by that, and we were appalled by that. But the other thing, Amy, we should mention when we talk about these soldiers being out there and being very jittery, they go around through the streets of Baghdad with their guns pointed right at the population. And when they hear shots, whether they're actually being fired at them or not, they fire. And we also talk to many people who lost loved ones and are doing so on a continual basis because these soldiers are out there shooting into the streets. So let's remember that there are Iraqi civilian casualties that we do not hear about when we hear about the soldiers being killed.
We have to break. When we come back, we're going to go to Baghdad to speak with two women there. We'll hear from one who founded a women's shelter in Baghdad, the effect of the general violence on the situation for women in Iraq. We're talking to Medea Benjamin, who has helped to found the Occupation Watch office in Baghdad, and Reverend Patricia Ackerman of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, just returned from Iraq. Stay with us. Kimbara, Celia Cruz and Johnny Pacheco. Celia Cruz is being buried today. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined by Medea Benjamin and Reverend Patricia Ackerman. They are part of the Occupation Watch office that has been set up in Baghdad. And now we go directly to Baghdad, to Nermeen Al-Mufti, who is co-director of that office in Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nermeen Al-Mufti.
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Kofi Annan has just called the Governing Council a broadly representative partner with whom the United Nations and the international community at large can engage. Do you agree?
No, Yani. First of all, Yani, I'm saying to myself just to give time for those 25 members, appointed members of the Governing Council. You know, there is priorities, and Iraq was occupied in the United States and Britain pretext was WMDs, and the second pretext was democracy and human rights and etc. So I think one of the elements of democracy is to elect your own representative, your own government, and those 25 were not elected by us, by the Iraqi people. They were appointed by Bremer, so I don't think they are going to represent me even in Iraq or in the Security Council or in front of United Nations. But still, I'm asking myself and my friends to give them time, maybe 1 week, 2 weeks, maybe 1 month, 2 months, but not more than 3 months, to see them in which way they are going to behave or to act. They are acting Iraqi or not Iraqi, but In time being, they are acting not Iraqi, and it was astonished for all of us that they decided to make April 9 the day forces occupied Baghdad. They decided it as a national day. So, yeah, until now they aren't Iraqi, and I heard that they are going. The economic committee in this council is going to sell all the public Iraqi public sector to the American first, then European companies. So this is two not Iraqi decisions. Still, they need time, and you are going to give them this time. Amy?
Yes. We're also going to hear from Yanar Mohammed, founder of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq and editor-in-chief of Al Musawat, which means equality. It's a newspaper. She returned to Iraq after 7 years in exile in Canada, and Reverend Patricia Ackerman spoke to her when she was in Iraq about the women's shelter that she set up.
Women in Iraq deserve a much better future. For the last 35 years, we have been oppressed by the Ba'ath regime, and all our previous achievements of women's groups have been aborted one after the other. All the amendments that we did to the civil law so as to improve our situation has changed the other way around. In the 90s, Saddam has made it really bad for us by introducing an article into the civil law that supports honor killings. After which the males in the families were able to kill any female for the mere suspect of her being honorless and go free on the streets. Within the 90s, only in the northern part of Iraq, 5,000 women were killed within what's called honor killings, and some of it was organized by the ruling parties. We have a big issue. Women are considered not a second-rate citizen in Iraq, I would say 10th-rate. And their humanity is not taken into consideration. If the Ba'ath regime, being as fierce as it was and as dominant as it was it was possible to change that reality in 1 month, why not change the situation the other way around after the war? That's why we are gathering here in Baghdad. Some of us were abroad and came back, and many of us are in Iraq, but they did not have a voice that was heard. We are getting together. We are setting up this organization. We're going to speak out against all the atrocities that are being committed against us as a gender and also as political agendas by many parties that are set to keep women in an inferior status in the society.
Yanar Mohammed, founder of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, also editor-in-chief of El Musawat, which means equality, and is a newspaper. Nermeen al-Mufti in Baghdad right now, co-director of the Occupation Watch Center in Iraq. What are you mainly doing right now with the center?
Just this morning, I was with many representatives and directors of NGOs in Iraq. We met director and deputy director of Amnesty International. So we have discussed many urgent and critical cases and violation of human rights in time being in Iraq, such as that, beginning that the occupation itself is a violation for the human dignity and sovereignty. So we have many special personnel, me myself. I'm working on a report about the kidnapping and raping Iraqi women. Yesterday I met a child. Her name is Sanaria. She's just 9 years old, and she was raped in a very brutal way. And also I'm after the limited authorities given by the state MPs to the Iraqi police. And also, we are. I'm with the Amnesty International. We decided that the Amnesty International tomorrow they are going to meet high-ranked officials in the CPA. So we have our demands. In which way they are going to present these demands, I don't know. But yeah, we have that the vacuum of security. The most urgent is the lack of security now. In Baghdad, especially maybe in the other province, cities, to some extent, you couldn't find this huge amount of raping and kidnapping women.
Nermeen Al-Mufti speaking from Baghdad. I wanted to ask before you both leave about one of the efforts that you're involved with in the Baghdad office, which has to do with advising U.S. soldiers on claiming conscientious objector status. Medea Benjamin.
Well, we didn't think of this as a something we would do as part of the center till we got there and we started talking to the soldiers. We realized how miserable their situation is. So that now that we're back here, we're talking to groups in the U.S. that have done this kind of counseling since the days of Vietnam. They're very interested in working with us on this. And so this is an area that we want to explore and potentially add to the work of the center, doing it from Baghdad.
You are going to be bringing some Nermeen Al-Mufti and other women to the United States to speak, Reverend Ackerman?
Yes, at the end of August, there will be a meeting in Baghdad for 300 women for 3 days, NGOs, international NGOs, sponsored by the UN. And we plan on having 3 to 4 women come back with us to the United States to speak around major cities and to tell their stories and to talk about what Americans can do to help support the grassroots movement.
Your website?
It's occupationwatch.org. We will be, well, we update it every single day. It's now become, I think, the best place to find out what's happening and what people in the movement who try to stop this war can do to stop the occupation.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Medea Benjamin and Reverend Patricia Ackerman, Reverend Ackerman of Fellowship of Reconciliation, Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange and Occupation Watch Center, Nermeen Al-Mufti from Baghdad at the Occupation Watch Center. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we wrap up with our final story, you may have heard about it. It happened on Friday. The chair of the Ways and Means Committee called on the Capitol Police yesterday with an unusual request to go after the Democrats who had gathered in a nearby library. Republican Bill Thomas called the police to arrest a group of Democratic members of the Ways and Means Committee. They had fled a late-night meeting to protest the way Republicans were handling a bill on pension. Democrats charged the Republicans were running the committee like a police state. The police refuse to make arrests. We're going to go to Juliet Alperin, who is a reporter with The Washington Post, who was there. But first to Congressmember Charles Rangel, who was one of those Congressmembers who took refuge in the library next door. I reached him just before today's program.
Well, the legislative procedure requires that all bills be read. But in cases where you have lengthy bills, such as the one that was before us Friday of 200 pages, the chairman normally asks unanimous consent that we waive the reading of the bill. And this is normally done because the members don't need a word-by-word reading since they normally have some knowledge as to what is in the bill. Since under normal circumstances, they've worked to compile the bill. But in this particular case, the bill was introduced a few minutes before midnight. The staff said that over the email came a description of the bill a few minutes after midnight. So when we met 10 o'clock that morning and the chairman asked the unanimous consent that the bill be read, be waived as being read, I objected because we had not seen the bill, had a chance to look at the bill, and while it annoyed the chairman, since objection is seldom given, and the fact is that most of the time we know what's in the bill, and so you don't have to object. And I took the Democrats to the rear of the hearing room where we have our conference room, which is called the Ways and Means Library. And while I was there and the clerk was reading the bill, the chief of staff of the Republican chairman came and told me that the chairman has ordered the Democrats out of our library. I asked why, and they said he may use it for a Republican meeting. And I advised her that to tell the chairman that we were not leaving. And then she came and she told me that the chairman told her to get the police. And she did come with the police. I asked the police what they intend to do. He said, no. He called his superior. They came and I asked whether we were under arrest. They said no. And then they brought the sergeant of arms who said it was a committee matter and not a law enforcement issue. And then the bells rang, which caused us to go to the floor to vote. And that was what was happening in the library.
That is Congressmember Charles Rangel on the line with us from Washington, Juliet Alperin, who is a reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to Democracy Now! Thanks. So you were, sorry, you were there.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe not only what happened in the library, but what happened with Congressmember Peter Stark, who remained the one Democrat at the House and Means Committee, the Ways and Means Committee?
Well, essentially what happened is that, and the Democrats, you know, called for this reading. They left behind Pete Stark while they went to the library to plot strategy about what they should do. Stark remained. They went through a reading of this bill. At one point, the chairman had called the police asking them to evict the Democrats from the library. Then there was a verbal scuffle between Stark and another member, a Republican from Colorado named Scott McGinnis.
I just came from Colorado Springs in Denver on Friday, and there was a lot being made of this interaction since he is from Colorado.
I can imagine in it, basically, Stark was trying to make an objection. Scott McGinnis from Colorado told him to shut up, and Stark then threatened him. And in fact called him a little fruitcake multiple times. Then they went back to going ahead with the reading, but then Bill Thomas, the chairman, got tired of that and simply banged down the gavel and said they were going to proceed. Stark had complained that he had objected, but Thomas said that it was too late. And at that point, the Republicans went ahead and proceeded with the bill and passed it, while Stark joined the other Democrats in the library and, you know, kind of participated in the media circus that had developed in the ensuing minutes.
So the chair of the Ways and Means Committee has called the police on the Democrats. Will there be any kind of response this week?
No, I don't think so. Essentially, the response we saw was the response we saw on Friday with the resolution on the House floor condemning this action, which failed on a party line vote. You know, there was a lot of debate. The bill in question, which is actually a bipartisan bill overhauling pension law, is expected to come to the floor this week. I guess there's a question of whether this controversy will affect the outcome of that bill. But again, given Republican control of the House and the fact that there are Democrats who support the bill, I think it's quite likely that the bill will pass.
Well, Juliet Alperin, thanks very much for joining us, talking about the Ways and Means Committee, not to be confused with the Ways to Be Mean Committee. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can sign up for our daily digest. That's democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Truf, Abdul Kadus, Lenina Nadal, and Nagara Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Democracy.